Welcome to the Agile Book Club. You're your hosts, Justina and Paul.
Today, this is going to be a good day. I'm excited about this one because today we're going to be interviewing somebody we've known for a very long time. How often do we say that? Next time, hopefully, we'll be talking to somebody we've never met before. But today...
We will. Actually, we never met, I think.
No, we haven't. But he also hasn't agreed to an interview yet.
Okay.
So we might be meeting Clark Ching, but I haven't asked him for an interview yet. I have to do that yet. So today we're going to be talking with somebody who's been an old friend for a very, very long time, Mike Burrows. He's written three books, all of them fabulous for different reasons. His first book was Kanban from the Inside, which was an exploration of Kanban from its principles and values. His second book was Agenda Shift, which is a how-to guide for any group of people, really, in order to agree on a set of objectives. And his most recent book, Right to Left, is an introductory guide to the Agile ecosystem for digital leaders, which also contains a number of very, very clever and very applicable ideas, both of his own and from his experience, that are applicable to Agile coaches at all levels as well. So please join us in welcoming to the podcast, Mike Burrows.
Hiya.
So thank you so much for joining us. It's delightful to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
We both very much enjoyed reading your new book, From Right to Left, although...
Yes, and I also brought a copy of your book to the current company that I'm working with. Yes, and I proudly gave it yesterday to the person who is like anti-agile and everything. I just said, look here at this pool of options that you have and let me know what do you think. So I promise to read it.
Do you know, I'm really pleased to hear that. One of the most gratifying things about the launch of this book is that people have been telling me that they're buying multiple copies to give away.
Yeah.
And, you know, the big challenge of the book was, you know, I knew I was writing a book for two audiences, but one of the audiences is buying the book for the other, which is really fantastic.
Yeah, let's wait for the Santa Claus in companies.
Well, we've certainly all been in companies or worked in companies or know people who have worked in companies in which the whole company strategy changes the moment the boss reads a book.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I guess a lot of people want their bosses to be thinking like you.
I hope so.
So can I start off by asking something that very curious about, which is, what is the most surprising response? Either the most controversial what has surprised you the most about the response that you're getting from this book?
I think this is my third book, and a sort of the instant positivity of the book was really amazing. You know, obviously you hope for that, but it was honestly more than I expected. And there were people who perhaps if they'd asked me nicely could have got a preview, but waited till it was actually published. And some of those people bought, as I said, but multiple copies even on trust before they'd read it. Other people who've been close to the project have done the same. So that has been really fantastic. Another big surprise actually. You made some comments that other people have made as well. I don't know if it's because you all listen or read to each other, but you know, the idea that people should start with the last two chapters and work backwards, perhaps taking the idea of reading it right to left perhaps a little bit too literally, I think again it goes to the issue that there's actually two audiences of this book. There's the practitioner audience and the sponsor audience perhaps. And I absolutely want both audiences to read it, and I want there to be something in it for both of them. So for the practitioner audience, there has to be something to make sponsor audience is an introductory book, still interesting and provocative. And I think it's just the stance that it takes is that. And, for the, the last two chapters contain stuff that perhaps most agile books don't actually get to, or they issue a whole load of opinions on why current organizations are broken without having much to offer in response to it. I actually would rather people read the book from the beginning, and I hope that the expert reader understands the spirit that the first four chapters are written in, and then carries that across into those last chapters. But I was very gratified to hear your response to those chapters, and other people have responded very positively to those as well.
Well, certainly it's nice to have a survey. It's one of the things that the two things I enjoy in your previous books are both in this book. The first is that when I talk to people about your first book, about Kanban from the Inside, I've been known to tell them that it's three books.
Yeah.
And that that middle book is really useful, because at the time that you wrote it, there was this rule in Kanban that you're supposed to improve using models.
Yeah.
But very few people knew what a model was or how to use the model. And you offered a very nice survey of all of the most commonly used models for improvement and for understanding complex environments
Yes.
that I've ever seen written in one place before. And you do the same thing with a survey of the agile landscape in this book.
Yes.
And the other
Yes.
thing that I enjoy, and which you did brilliantly in Agenda Shift, is to actually give the reader not just a bunch of ideas, but a toolkit, something that they can take
Yes.
to work and do. And you do that in this latest book as well.
Yes. I mean, I kind of started something with Kanban from the Inside. I decided life's too short to, waste, pages, column inches on bashing other things. And I'd much rather, better understand how do they complement each other, work with each other, and so on. And the organizing idea of Kanban from the Inside was that model of nine values. And you're seeing that sort of idea resurface in Right to Left. The organizing idea in Right to Left isn't values, but outcomes. I mean, two very closely related concepts. So organizing by values, as I did in Kanban from the Inside, helps you understand how why it is that so many different frameworks, when you look under the covers, have such, similarity in things like principles and values, and to an extent, the practices, but we all focus on the difference in practice rather than the concepts that underpin them all. Integrating via outcomes, as I've done in Right to Left, I think really helps to show how these things can actually work together, feed each other, complement each other, and whether it's the same people or different people using different frameworks. And that really was the intention, particularly of Chapter 3, the big survey of the Lean Agile landscape.
Actually, was there something more that you planned to include in this book, but you didn't? I mean, in Right to Left.
There is one area where it was kind of bubbling under the surface as I was writing Right to Left, and I sort of pushed it to one side. I wouldn't go as far as saying it's a regret, but if there's ever a second edition of Right to Left, it'll probably get covered. And I think it's quite likely there'll be a second edition of Agenda Shift in due course, because we're just moving forward quickly enough that it'll kind of be a necessity. And that area is OKR. Objectives and key results. And it is very much in my sight. So, you can expect to hear me saying more about OKR, offering OKR workshops and things next year. OKR is, alongside, a lot of, process frameworks, agile frameworks, is one of those things where, if you go about it the right way, implement it with the right spirit, with the right attitude, it can be amazing. It can be wonderful. I mean, if you read, John Doerr's book, for example, and you look at how it worked in Intel, it was clearly spectacularly successful. And yet, we're probably all familiar with the stories of how horrible management by objectives got. Mm-hmm. And OKR and MBO are they are very close cousins. So how do you avoid the dysfunction? And anything where the way you approach it makes a massive difference to how successful it is. In fact, the difference between being success and worse than failure, actually doing active harm, that makes it something where, I think Agenda Shift has something to offer, actually a tool that helps leaders and organizations approach you know, significant change like this in a way, you know, likely to deliver something of value, whether it was the original thing intended or something else. So OKR is one area where I could have got into it. Honestly, I was a bit scared of it. I wrote a quite successful blog post in the last few weeks, called, cautiously positive on OKR or something, some similar title, that's got quite a bit of attention. And I, you know, kind of explained the risk, explained the dilemma. But it helped to crystallize for me that actually it is something I absolutely should be focusing on.
And it fits so nicely with the right-to-left approach.
It really does, yes.
The function of OKRs is when they're used to drive behavior from above.
Yes,
from a position,
yes.
From a point of ignorance, yes. Of the right-hand side of the organization.
Yes.
Whereas if you approach OKRs from a right-to-left perspective, then they're very focused on the right-hand side. They're very focused on the customer experience, and they can be motivational to the people who are closest to the customer,
yes.
Experience.
What Agenda Shift was all about was, you know, talking about outcomes in such a way that the people close to the work could work out how those outcomes could best be achieved. And that becomes a leadership discipline when once leaders can articulate outcomes in the right way and have conversations about outcomes in the right way, you are then allowing people to self-organize and innovate and collaborate on what the solution is going to look like. And that's a very powerful thing. And I think it's a really essential thing if Agile is going to get any serious kind of traction in an organization. And everything I've just said is very, you know, very necessary for OKR as well. I mean, you know, if people are working out for themselves what they should be working on, what key results they should be achieving in order to, you know, move the needle on some objective, then you're beginning to harness the creativity of the organization. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, very much in my kind of territory, I think.
And it's the right-to-left thinking that opens up the possibility for those people who are closest to the coalface, as we said in South Africa,
yes.
To question whether or not the tasks that are being assigned to them are the best way to achieve those objectives.
Exactly. I might even question the practice of assigning tasks. But yes, I agree with you. Well, it depends what you mean by a task, of course. But that's one of my trigger words.
Yes. But you know how it actually works in practice.
Yes.
Is that a programmer's working on a project, but they don't know why they're working on that project and not on a different project.
Yes. Yes, yes. I've actually had people leave my workshops, a two-day workshop, and come back the next day and said, I had a sleepless night last night. And one of them was, he said, you know, I realized for, you know, all the time I've been in this organization, and it was an organization with a worthy purpose, I got to say, you know, he realized he was given a piece of work and he did it. Given a piece of work and he did it. And he just had so little consideration for what the actual effect of that work was going to be. Often didn't know whether the work he did actually fulfilled any kind of need, you know, at all, and so on. And, you know, what I've been doing for the last few years is actually focusing people on that, you know, on that sort of critical moment when, you know, the need is met. And making sure that everything we do is focused on that, leads up to that, that we check that it actually happens, it checks that we know what the need was, that who the person was, and all the rest of it. And just so many good things follow when you start to do that.
So we talked about what you didn't include in this book. I'd like to talk about a little bit about something you did include in this book that I found,
yep,
compelling. So I very much like the way that you handled SAFE in this book. And one of the reasons why it jumped out at me is because obviously your first book was about Kanban, and you give a very fair and balanced treatment to SAFE and Scrum as well. And one of the best short descriptions of SAFE, its strengths and weaknesses, and its applicability and possible areas of inapplicability that I've seen. What kind of feedback have you gotten from that, from the SAFE community?
First of all, I would say that part of the book was the most carefully written of any of it. What I was anxious not to do was start a stupid flame war. I also wasn't going to indulge in gratuitous SAFE bashing as well. And in a way, not do what everybody probably expected me to do. Now, I think, you know, when I've had the... talked about the book and, you know, recent blog posts that have gone completely crazy, you know, just in the last few days. I've been really gratified by the response. You know, perhaps a very tiny minority, you know, reacting defensively to it. But the vast majority of people responding to it, whether they are pro-safe or anti, you know, grateful that, you know, I said something thoughtful. And that's the only way I will go in writing on controversial topics. I mean, if you're going to get me to go further than that, it's going to cost you a few beers, I should think. So I'm glad that bit stood out for you. The big issue is, and it goes back to things I said already. It's so easy to focus on the differences in practices between different frameworks, or the difference in process between different frameworks. I think when you start to get to the scaling frameworks, it's not just that there are so many of those practices to point at and criticize. It is that the sheer scale of it becomes an issue as well, and causes an instinctive negative reaction in some people. And I'll be, you know, completely honest, that is my instinctive reaction as well, is to worry about the sheer size of it. But just to criticize it for that when people clearly are getting some value from it, you know, it doesn't get you anywhere. And so, you know, I think it's important again to focus on how can you use it in a way that is useful, does bring value? What are the potential or even likely dysfunctions of approaching it the wrong way, and so on? And I try to crystallize those thoughts in just a few pages in the book. The book isn't designed to make anybody an expert on SAFE, but anyone reading it will have at least an idea of its, you know, its scope. And I hope will be encouraged to think, you know, quite carefully about how they would approach it if they think it's something they should be looking at.
Yeah, actually, what you said was one of the feedback that I had previously, and that I heard from my friend who also read the book, that it was a nice set of crystallized ideas, as you mentioned. But I was just wondering if you had any information from the community that some of them were like misunderstood by them, because it's hard to extract the essence of everything and put it into just a chapter. I cannot imagine how challenging it is when you deal with such a complex thing. So I was curious.
Not from the SAFE community. I mean, I didn't. I mean, the book isn't just written from just from what I was able to scrape from the web. You know, it did involve talking to people. You know, some mm-hmm. suspicions confirmed by talking to them, but also you know, put right on things as well. So I honestly think I've written it carefully enough that I it hasn't generated a backlash, and a lot of positive response, perhaps not specifically to the book, but to the blog post that went out this week. I mean, it's now my top post of the year within a day and a half of publication. So that gives you an idea of just how quickly that one exploded. I've had one interesting bit of feedback. It's not from someone who's read the book, but it came about in a Twitter conversation. And that was I think it was a very good comment, and that's about being careful not to be reductionist. When I talk about lean, it inevitably becomes a discussion about flow. And it's very easy to say that lean is, you know, all about flow, and from there it is only about flow. And that will, that will annoy certain people. Mm-hmm. So that was a useful reminder that it's when you're coming from one particular framework as your standpoint, it's very easy to be, to belittle others. And I try not to do that casually. I may occasionally do it accidentally, but it's certainly not meant with any ill intent. Yeah.
Okay. I was also wondering about one thing. Actually, since almost 2 years, since you were at the ACE conference.
Is it that long? That's amazing.
Yes, it's already almost 2 years, yeah. What is like the biggest challenge when you work with digital leaders?
That's a very good question. I've got to say that you're talking about a very diverse bunch of people, some of whom are technologists, some aren't. And of the ones that aren't, some are, you know, have a big vision of what is possible, you know, through going digital, others that don't. I think some, you know, at sort of what we might call sort of sponsor level, are a bit too detached from the process, and that is very frustrating when you're doing something that inevitably has, you know, organizational impact, and you do actually need people who are going to be involved and, you know, and show some leadership, you could say. There are others that are perhaps a bit too keen to sell their pet ideas, their pet projects. And, you know, the real big thing, what digital makes, we're talking agile about agile being an empirical process. The digital space just makes that so much easier. I mean, you literally have the opportunity to measure the behavior of your users. It's so easy to form hypotheses about user behavior and to actually test them. And you are leaving vast amounts of value on the table if you're not doing that. And, you know, in the early days of your project, if project's the right word, you know, finding other ways to validate your assumptions about what users need, what customers need, and how they will behave. So there is some education to be done there. I mean, people in corporations or government departments, you know, and I work with both, are so used to these big projects with big specs and big projects and painful deliveries and all the rest of it. And they are so used to having the lessons learned meeting at the end of the project, in which not very much gets learned because they've actually not got the ability to enact any learning. To go from that to what is actually a paradigm shift to one where, you know, actually the focus is on user behavior from the very beginning. That's an important thing to convey.
So if you could have just one day of working with digital leaders, and your task would be to teach them one thing that will improve their life and business forever, what that would be?
Yeah. I think it's a well known, I mean, it's been known for decades, if not longer, that your leaders, especially, you know, in corporations, need to have just a few goals to be focusing on. And I think it's not understood that, you know, there's actually that in that simple piece of advice, you know, limit yourself to three priorities or whatever, there is actually twice the value there. It's not just having three projects to focus on, it's having three outcomes to focus on and allowing other people to help you understand how those outcomes are going to be realized. And the more that you can defer the detail on how things are going to be achieved, the more you unleash the creativity of the people around you. So it's kind of twice the value out of that old piece of advice, you know. Just a limited number of outcomes to focus on and, you know, empower people, encourage participation in the process of realizing those outcomes.
And that also mirrors something that Klaus said to us when we interviewed him, which is you limit WIP where you want to see the improvement.
Mm. Yes, absolutely.
You had mentioned that there's this book was written for one audience, but it clearly has two audiences, and one of
them. I very definitely wrote it for two audiences from the beginning.
Ah, okay.
And that was the challenge. So the challenge is to make it interesting to practitioners and still accessible to non-practitioners. So yeah, the trick there is it's the stance that makes it interesting to practitioners. It's the breadth and I hope the positivity that will make it attractive to sponsors.
I think most agile coaches go through a long period of time when they have very little contact with sponsors. I mean, the journey usually begins at the team level.
Yep.
Some coaches' careers never really go beyond the team level. And so there's a point at which somebody has had a significant amount of experience working with teams, with groups of teams. And I think the people that this book is probably really resonating with are the people who are having their initial encounters with those digital leaders.
Yes.
What, and it's got to be frightening. I remember the first time that I ran into a CTO and had to have a meeting with a CTO in a major bank, and it was terrifying because
yes,
it's a different conversation. What advice would you give to agile coaches who have gotten to that point in their career where they're no longer talking to teams, but they're being asked to advise and contribute at higher levels in the organization?
Yes. I'll first start by saying a phrase, I don't know if I originated it, and I apologize if somebody else did, but, you know, empathy is a superpower. And, you know, don't let your expertise get in the way of your empathy. I've noticed agile coaches can be a very dogmatic and judgmental bunch and will opine on things of which they have no direct experience themselves. And I think, you know, understanding, you know, the environments that people work in, that live in, understand the pressures that they're under, the constraints that they're working with, and so on, is very important. If you can't do that, and if you can't show some empathy towards the people that you're working with, you are honestly going to find it very hard. You'll just be seen as someone with an opinion that is easily dismissed. And it kind of following on from that is my advice would be, you know, don't assume that the answer all lies in process. And in particular, you know, if you're going to look at process, look at it right to left and not left to right. You know, plowing through backlogs of requirements is the way to deliver mediocre systems. And you've got to do better than that. So you've got to find ways of getting people, as I keep saying, find ways to get people to collaborate, self-organize, innovate, you know, around outcomes, and actually confirm that they are actually meeting people's needs. You know, and if everything you're doing at the sort of front end of the process isn't achieving that, then you're going to achieve perhaps some small improvements in in productivity, but you're not going to achieve the real shift that that you need to thrive in the digital world.
Mm. So, in other words, treat executives the same way you treat your own teams.
Yes.
Apply empathy. Don't assume you have all of the answers. Just like an experienced agile coach joining a new team,
yes,
is going to keep their mouth shut for quite a while,
yes,
to see what's working and what's not,
yes,
and how things are working. And they should have the confidence and the empathy to do the same thing with executives.
Yes, yes. I mean, like you.
So that's a similarity.
Yes, I mean, like you. I've worked that, worked to that level on sort of both sides of the table, for a number of years. And so it feels sort of natural and obvious to me. But you put it very well. You know, in the end, managers are people too. And that seems to get forgotten sometimes. And I think that's unfortunate.
So what are the differences? How is coaching executives different than coaching programmers and testers?
I think, and perhaps it's hard, and until you've either spent a lot of time with them or you've been one yourself, I think people don't understand what a balancing act it is to be a manager. You're operating within constraints. There are always more, the expectations always exceed, what's possible. But actually, Agile and Lean both have, they have lots to offer in terms of helping people, managing with constraints, get better focus, get a better understanding of people's needs, all these kind of things. They all can help. My advice though is just not to jump too quick with the prescriptions. Do spend some time, understanding, or even better, helping people themselves come to an understanding. The whole, basis of agenda shift is agreement on outcomes. And if you can facilitate agreement on outcomes and it's genuine agreement from, the people, impacted by their agreement, then that's golden. You can work from that. How to achieve those outcomes is now just a problem to be solved. I mean, and just is another trigger word for people, but that is you have changed the game very significantly once you've got agreement on what we want to achieve, and that counts for not just product things, but ways of working type things as well. I mean, people recognise when, for example, the system is overburdened, people are trying to do too many things at once, and if you can get agreement on, well, can we find some things to focus on? Can we decide on something to deliver? You've already got the beginnings of a way forward.
Speaking of agreement, recently I had this kind of experience that people really, really wanted to change, make their system more agile and the interaction agile. But on the other hand, when we started working on that, I was getting answers that it was always the way it is right now and it was working. Like, they wanted to have a change. They wanted to improve the outcomes. They really wanted that and still want. But on the other hand, there was this huge resistance for change. How would you tackle that?
It's all about the outcomes. I mean, if you look at my, particularly my gender shift materials, the words lean and agile just hardly ever occur. I'm not sure in the workshop deck if they occur anywhere. But what we do is describe, what it feels like when it's working well, and encourage people to articulate for themselves what it feels like when it's working well. And if people are already talking about outcomes, we'll work with that. You know, the fact that the solution comes from lean or agile is neither here nor there, when it comes to it. Mm-hmm. The moment that agile becomes the goal, or the implementation of a framework becomes the goal, then you are going down a very dangerous path. And that is the essence of my issue with SAFe, is that, if you see SAFe as a solution to be implemented, you are asking for a lot of pain. Now, that's actually true of any framework. It's just the degree of pain, the amount of damage that you can do is going to vary according to the size and scope of the thing you are trying to implement. So I'm completely consistent about this. This isn't bashing SAFe or finger pointing. There's a general principle to be drawn here. Be very careful about what your goals are.
I had one more question regarding a service delivery review that we both enjoyed with Paul a lot.
Yes.
What would you say are the key ingredients? I know that you included them in the book, but maybe for those listeners who haven't read the book yet, it might be a nice invitation.
Yes. The first thing to remember is that a service delivery review has got to be about service. So you've got to start with, who you are servicing, who your customers are, and how well you are serving them. There is a tendency to focus on some, technical metrics, things like, cycle time, lead time, whatever you want to call it, and so on. But I think you actually have to start with not just measures of the customer experience, but stories of the customer experience as well. And the particular agenda that I set out in the book is outside in. It starts with the customer. We work our way inwards, and it's the same agenda actually for the strategy review as well. And the tools are different, but the overall agenda is the same. What is it like when we are actually serving our customers well? What's it like when we are reaching the right customers, meeting their strategic needs? If this is the strategy review. And that is the standpoint. I mean, there's a whole workshop just in that one sentence, really. But we go from there to, well, what kind of organization do we need to be if we're going to achieve that? With what products and services are we going to do that? And so on. And, and kind of, what are we doing at the team level, comes last, not because it's the least important, but because if it doesn't align to all those other things, then we're doing something wrong. There's a contradiction to be addressed. And the service delivery review, I strongly suggest, presenting your different experiments, progress, updates, problems, metrics in that order, and by people who have real, competence and, first-hand experience in those areas. And it then becomes a way to integrate the work of different teams or different sub-teams and so on.
Mm-hmm. I especially like the way you combine that with the idea of having three levels of leadership, not the word, three levels of hierarchy represented. Because I think one of the areas in which service delivery reviews so often fail is that the right people aren't in the room.
Yes.
And so there's misinterpretations. The senior management wants to hear the outcome
Yes.
of the meeting. But without being in the room, there are all sorts of biases and heuristics that can interfere with their understanding of the issues that were expressed and explored.
Yes.
So, and on the way down as well,
Yes.
if you've only got management in the room talking to the client and they come out and they say these are the dissatisfactions, the workers can say, well, we haven't seen any of that in our interactions with
Yes, them. Yes. So I have what I call my rule of three, which is kind of what you're alluding to. You know, at least three levels of seniority in the room. Three, by the way, is a minimum. If you've read Team of Teams, General Stanley McChrystal, which I think is a great, great book, you know, in the army or the military services and plus intelligence services and all these other services that were in his meeting, I think he talked about introducing on first name terms somebody who was, I think it was nine levels of seniority below him. I mean, you know, I shudder to think of, you know, a kind of a work meeting with nine levels of seniority. But the point was, you know, really well taken. You've got to have a realistic view of what's happening on the ground, as well as a strategic view of where we'd like to be going. And you don't have a strategy if you don't have a connection between the two. And you're not going to execute your strategy well if you can't maintain that connection. So I see service delivery review as one very important mechanism for making sure that that is actually happening. And it's not just about the agenda. It's not just about the metrics that you use. It's about making, you know, you're keeping the right people involved. And, you know, the strategy and the operations and development of new capabilities and so on, you know, they have the opportunity to inform and energize each other, you know, over time. And they're not just sort of one-off events.
You know, it's interesting when you said that, the idea that it is, in fact, incredibly rare to get very many levels of management, like seven, eight, nine levels of management in a room at the same time. And I have experienced that more than once.
Yes.
And it's when there are large-scale objectives that are cultural in nature and go through the entire organization. And so the places where I've seen a room that has every level of the company in the same room talking about the same thing with the same objectives is with my work in diversity and inclusion.
Yes, yes.
So there's probably a lot to learn from consultants who work in these sorts of large-scale culture shift like diversity and inclusion, disability and sexual orientation training, the kind of things that just require change at every level of the organization. An organization can get together around these sorts of issues in a way that they don't around things like process, objectives, goals, strategy.
Yes. I mean, there's a phrase you might have come across me using a few times recently. You know, I say, you know, for parts of the mainstream agile movement, it's as though the last 20 years, the last two decades of modern organizational development never happened. All those things that you talked about, you know, all the work that's gone into things like, you know, dialogic organization development and so on. There's some amazingly powerful stuff there, you know, the kind of stuff that I'm, you know, referencing in Agenda Shift. And, you know, the idea of the, you know, the linear imposition of a process as a way to achieve agile change, I find just appalling. And I, you know, when I get uppity, it's on that issue. You know, I find most other things to do with agile frameworks is just detail, and I find it very hard to get super excited about them. But on the issue of imposition, it's a big deal, and I've staked my career now on, you know, needs and outcomes and participation as the way forward, and that applies to delivery, it applies to strategy, it applies to culture change, it applies to agile adoption and transformation, and so on. So you're completely right to, you know, to reference, you know, those kind of tools, those kind of experiences. Okay, some of this I learned by accident. I remember when I first joined UBS, the investment bank, I did some leadership training, and I was a humble associate director, just joined after being a contractor with a view to being promoted. And I found myself sat next to for a week in some training with the managing director of the business from the other side of the Atlantic, from the US. And that was really valuable from a, you know, social point of view, quite as much as anything, you know, business-wise or technical. And I then heard Dave Snowden talking about training as being an opportunity to build social capital in your organization. I mean, you can focus training on particular teams, or you can deliberately bring people together who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to work together. and, you know, it creates opportunities that otherwise wouldn't be had. And I've used that, you know, more recently. I've had, for example, a new joiner in one of my workshops sat next to the CIO, and everyone thought it was, first of all, hilarious and then fantastic. It really works. You know, what a fantastic opportunity for that person to, as well as getting, you know, something new while everyone else was getting something new, also to be exposed to how the organization thinks and its own acknowledgements of where it needs to be doing better. And I thought that was fantastic. They thought that was fantastic.
That really creates all sorts of exciting opportunities for other ways to think about training. And I hope that our listeners are looking for ways that they can apply those ideas in their own workplaces in order to facilitate conversations towards a healthier work environment.
Yes.
So this has been delightful, Mike. Is there anything that you think that we missed? Anything that you really are burning to talk about that we didn't ask you about?
I think I've covered it. I think at the beginning of your podcast, I must admit, I was slightly worried. I was thinking, are you dismissing this book? But clearly you weren't. You took it seriously. You clearly enjoyed it. You know, some parts of it you clearly highly valued, and I'm grateful for that. I knew, you know, even before I published it, it was a risk that people would take the survey parts, when we talk about the survey of the landscape, not seriously enough, think of it as being shallow and not realize that it's the perspective rather than the detail that's important. So, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity that we've had to talk about that. And I'd like to mention it again. I think we've covered what we need to cover. Now, we've done outside in, the outside in strategy review, the outside in service delivery reviews. We haven't talked about servant leadership and so on. That was the last chapter. But people can read the book and enjoy that. That's been another part that people have particularly called out.
Oh, yes. That was the best definition that I've seen. And I referred to in the previous podcast that currently I'm working with this kind of the servant leader, and she's amazing. And when I heard your words, I've just pictured her and everything.
That's wonderful. I mean, I referenced Robert Greenleaf in my writing. I think there's lots of very informal definitions of what servant leadership is about out there. Mm-hmm. And most of them don't add up to very much. And for some of them, you wonder, well, where's the leadership in that? I can see the serving bit, but where's the leadership part of that? But it is a really crucial thing. I won't sort of replay it all now, but I encourage people to read that part of the book. And that is another, passion area, for me. I've got the 25th edition of the Greenleaf book, Servant Leadership. It's already an old book. I think that we might be coming up to the 50th anniversary edition before long. But I've read it multiple times, and I'm inspired by it every time I read it. And one of the things I love to do is to point people in the direction of other books. There's lots of footnotes in the book, references to other books. There's a web page on the site as well with all the references. But that is absolutely a key one.
Yeah, that's something that I've been very keenly aware of, but I haven't actually articulated in my discussion of this book. And it's similar to your first book as well, is that one of the very, very valuable parts of the book is so easily overlooked, and that's the bibliography.
Yes.
You're very, very well read, you've done a lot of research, and you've identified a number of ideal sources for some of the most powerful ideas that could transform our work and our community, and brought them together in a single bibliography. And I appreciate you putting that on a web page. We'll put that web page in the show.
Yes. Yeah. Agendashift.com/books will give you links to the pages for the book, and from those, the book bibliographies. Or recommended reading, as I call it. You know, I'm genuinely encouraging people to read these other books.
So thank you very much, Mike. As always, it's been delightful to talk to you.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. It's been great for me too. Thank you.
Well, you know what the thing is the fact that our setup is a little different every time, and we have to just create it. If we had a studio, we could walk into and hit the button.
In 15 minutes.
Or an engineer. Or
if we weren't so darn alone.
So we got a new Patreon subscriber at the $5 level yesterday, and we have to send him a thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had enough supporters, if we had enough subscribers, we could hire an engineer.
We got the new one, yes, you said.
Yes, we got one. Mihao. Mihao's giving us $5 a month.
Oh, Mihao!
Isn't that sweet? So yeah, he's supporting us.
Oh, Michał, I wish you could see my smile. You will see it on AIDS Express.